Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll dig into the latest indictments against President Trump and others, this time in the state of Georgia. First, 1967 is a year that Green Bay Packers fans and fans of pro football in general will recall as the year of the first Super Bowl. Packers 35, Chiefs 10, by the way. Back up a few decades now to 1920, the official founding of the National Football League. But what happened before that? Pro football in America didn't just appear in 1920. Not only is there a nearly three-decade history of professional football before then, that story includes a game-fixing scandal that almost killed the sport in the country altogether. Our next guest spent about a decade researching that history, which includes a family connection to it all. And as the NFL's preseason gets underway, we're going to take a look way back at where it all started. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the origins of pro football in the United States? Is this something you have followed or looked into yourself? Do you happen to have any family connections that date back to the early days of pro football? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Greg Fisseri is a native of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. His new book is called Gridiron Legacy, Pro Football's Missing Origin Story. Greg, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
This is an amazing journey in the book, Greg, and it started off with you going through your great-grandpa's photos. Can you tell us what kicked off this project for you?
That's right. I knew growing up in Pittsburgh at my grandmother's house in a little industrial suburb called Wilmerding, about 10 miles east of the city, that he was one of the greats of the pre-NFL era. He was a center before the forward pass, so he was a key to the offensive line. And the forward pass was legalized in 1906, and he played for every world championship team in Pittsburgh and in Massillon, Ohio, from 1901 to 1906. So there were a few pictures on her wall that gave me put me on the scent, but it wasn't until she passed away in 2007 and I was cleaning out her house that I discovered the real treasure, which was a box of dozens of more original photos from his career, individual photos, team photos, buddy pictures. Some were identified, some weren't. And it led me to ask a lot of questions, find resources, find people that could help me identify the whole lot. And once I had it, sort of the story together, I ended up going to the Hall of Fame in 2012, and they really were amazed and validated how unique the whole collection was, that they hardly had anything from that period. And there is still much to be told about the story of that period and the for the original pioneers of the game that had been lost. So
I want to take this. I want to set the scene now with the early days, the first paid pro football players. Now, the college sport was big in the United States at this point. The rules that separated American football as we know it now from, you know, soccer and rugby had been in place for a couple decades now. It's a big college sport. Not a lot of interest initially in watching it at the pro level. Set that scene. What was America's attitude toward amateur and pro football at this time?
Correct. College football officially started in 1869. We had CFB 150 in 2019, 150 years. Princeton and Rutgers in New Jersey was the first game in 1869. The Scarlet Knights of New Jersey wore little red scarlet caps on their heads. And from there, the Ivy League ran with it. Harvard, Yale, Princeton were the big three. Penn came a little bit later, but they dominated the sport. And into the 1890s, it was then, you know, played at an amateur level, governed by the AAU, Amateur Athletic Union, covered and sort of supervised national championship sports in basketball, swimming, wrestling, you know, several sports. So if you were going to compete in anything AAU, it had to be at an amateur level. Professionalism was seen as sort of unethical, and it wasn't supported by the general public. So when football, you know, became popular at the adult level and played at many clubs, the main five in Pittsburgh were sponsored because there was a lot of money in the Industrial Revolution in Pittsburgh by companies. Homestead Steel became Carnegie Steel, became U.S. Steel. Homestead Steel sponsored a team that was the Western Pennsylvania champion in 1900 and sort of initially called the world champions in 1901 because they played a team from Philadelphia outside of Pittsburgh. And this was the first effort, really, to professionalize the sport. Eventually, somebody would get paid cash, and that would define the first pro player. So, and in 1892, it was discovered by the Hall of Fame when they opened in 1963 that a player named William Pudge Heffelfinger from Yale, an All-American, had received $500 in cash to play for them, for the Allegheny Athletic Association against their rival Pittsburgh Athletic Club. So they found this accounting ledger that they call the birth certificate of pro football, and it's on display in the Hall of Fame that showed that Heffelfinger got paid $500 in cash, which was a huge sum at that point, to play one game. And that defined the beginning of the pro era. So it went on in Pittsburgh from 1892 until 1902. And my great-grandfather played. His name was Bob Shiring for this Homestead team in 1901 that was the world championship team. And that was, at that point, the first picture I had of him on a football team. And that really started the journey. When the Hall of Fame said, you know, if you can combine these photos you have with a narrative that is missing the solution to an alleged gambling scandal in 1906, in which the championship games between the Maslin Tigers and Canton Bulldogs in Ohio may have been rigged, you could really have something special.
Talking to Greg Fisseri. His new book is called Gridiron Legacy, Pro Football's Missing Origin Story. It can be hard to imagine today with the height of the NFL, but pro football was once a touch-and-go operation. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about the early days of football. That's 800-642-1234. If you've dug into the family history of someone like Greg and your family who was involved in the early days of football, maybe with a little team out of Green Bay, I don't know. Join in at 800-642-1234. Greg, I want to bring it home to Wisconsin a little bit here. Now, in the era you described before that gambling scandal, which we're going to get into in just a bit, teams were competing for players, and there were some hot commodities from a college in the Midwest called the University of Wisconsin. There were some players in high demand from here, right?
That's right. The Maslin Tigers recruited the entire Badgers backfield, three running backs, right in the midst of the 1906 season to give them an extra edge to get past the rival Canton Bulldogs. That's a great find.
Now, you mentioned there were two superpower teams in Ohio, and it culminates in 1906 in this weird, kind of complicated payoff scandal. Give us the broad strokes. How much trouble did this put pro football in at that time?
I'm sorry. How much did it what? I missed it.
How big an impact did the? Tell us a little bit about the scandal and how it almost jeopardized pro football in the U.S.
Sure. So as the facts became clear, it turned out to be true. As the Maslin newspaper reported after the second of the two championship games between the Tigers and the Bulldogs that year, one of the Tigers players had received $50,000 to offer to various players in a pool to get them to fix the outcomes of these games. And they wanted them to split them and then perhaps play a third game for and get more people to come and buy more tickets and so on. Rumors were circulating, and there were denials made, and the games went on. And as it turned out, they did split those games, and that led more people to believe that the games were fixed. So the Massillon paper came out with a story the following day after a big bar fight broke out in which some people accused the Canton players of fixing the games, and they denied it, and somebody went through the glass window just like in a Burt Reynolds movie. But the story in the Massillon paper did admit that there was an attempted bribe and that they kicked the player off of their team for doing so. And they also accused the Canton captain, Blondie Wallace, of colluding in this scam. And he vigorously denied it. And even the other player from Massillon who participated denied it, that Wallace was involved. But nonetheless, he could never clear his name. So as that trial, and he sued the Massillon paper for libel, as that trial dragged on for a couple of years, people lost patience and lost interest in the game. And they didn't trust that it was on the up and up. So it dragged, the effects of it dragged on basically from 1906 until 1915. Football continued to be played, but it went back to the local and amateur semi-pro level at best. And just lost the instant popularity that it had gained when all the best players in the country had been attracted to that Eastern Ohio. So it wasn't until Jim Thorpe came back around and was recruited by a fellow named Jack Cusack, who volunteered to run the second version of the Canton Bulldogs. He was actually the ball boy or equipment kid for Canton back in the first era in 1906, and he loved the experience so much he stepped up and said he wanted to help resurrect the game. And it was his idea to bring Jim Thorpe in after Thorpe had won the gold medals for the decathlon and pentathlon in the 1912 Olympics. He was the world's greatest athlete, national icon, and they thought if Thorpe played, people would come back. And they were right. People loved Jim Thorpe, and he brought thousands of fans to the games.
We're talking with Greg Fisseri about his new book. It's called Gridiron Legacy, Pro Football's Missing Origin Story. You can join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about the early days of pro football, before there even was a National Football League? Is this conversation bringing back memories for you about maybe stories you heard from family members or others about the old days of pro football? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about the early days of professional football in America. Our guest is Greg Fisseri, author of the new book, Gridiron Legacy, Pro Football's Missing Origin Story. You could join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question for our guest about the pre-NFL days. Let's bring on a caller now. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Hey, Marcus.
Hey, Rob. So my thought that I've had for a while just about pro football is, what if we went back to something more resembling like the original helmets and pads, not the leather ones, but where they just had the one, you know, small chin strap or whatever, and you know, less shoulder pads and what, because I think that there would be less CTE in terms of brain injuries as well as just other injuries, because the players could no longer be guided human missiles.
Marcus, thanks for the call. Greg, can you paint us a picture? What kind of padding and protective gear were these players wearing and not wearing when they played in this era?
They weren't wearing much more than some canvas pants and some knit jerseys. They had the option to stitch in some padding into their shoulders and maybe stick some wooden slats into their thighs. But I've heard that thought over the past few years, and my reaction to that is it probably wouldn't work very well. In fact, in 1905, more than 20 players died from football-related injuries. not necessarily on the field, but broken necks, backs, head injuries, and so on. And a lot of that had to do with the rules at the time, which included a flying wedge formation, in which it was a V formation, and the runner got behind the V, and they sort of attacked the weakest link on the defense, and it was pretty brutal. So 1906 became a transformational year with the rules when President Teddy Roosevelt forced some rule changes to try to fix the game. People thought he might kill it, but he didn't. He liked the game. He liked the concept of masculine Christianity and the Rough Riders from the military that he put together. But so he got some of the luminaries of the game, Walter Camp, Amos Alonzo Stagg, John Heisman, to form a committee that became the NCAA to implement a line of scrimmage and the forward pass and 10 yards instead of 5 for a first down. I think things to open up the game, because it was so brutal before that. So I think probably the more pads we have, and the better, but I don't know how to, I'm not sure any helmet is going to solve the injury issue at the pace that these men play at.
Marcus, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Greg Fisseri about his new book, Gridiron Legacy, Pro Football's Missing Origin Story, looking at the early days, the pre-NFL days. We're talking over 100 years ago of professional football here in the United States. Greg, can you talk a little more about what the game looked like? If an NFL fan of today went back and watched a game, what do you think might stand out about the action on the field and the tactics involved?
It wouldn't feel like there was much action if you've already seen what it's become today. I think it was a lot of, they called them mass plays, sort of like rugby. One of the main changes in the rule that diverted American football away from rugby was the snapback, which, sort of breaking up plays from a constant – the constant movement and scrums in rugby. So it was just a lot of pushing and shoving the ball down the field, sort of like a contest of strength. But slowly, I think the game became faster and faster, and, fits and starts with rule changes. 1906, as I said, was pivotal. But even with the first forward pass, and by the way, my great-grandfather snapped the ball for the first forward pass with the Massillon Tigers in 1906. Fun footnote. But it was a fumble when there was an incomplete pass. So it wasn't like they were chucking the ball, 40 times a game right away.
Now, I'm looking at pictures, and you've got a lot of great pictures in your book, Greg. Your great-grandpa looks like a pretty big guy by the standards of the time. By the standards of modern-day NFL, I'm guessing even he would look pretty tiny lined up on an offensive line.
Yeah, Big Bob Shiring, as he was called, was about 240, 250 at center, and pretty dominant with the 6 straight world championships. So there were several players, the backs, quarterbacks, running backs, 160 to 180 pounds was about it. There was a fellow named Arthur Poe from Princeton, who was a relative of Edgar Allan Poe, and he was an All-American, great, fast player, and his knee would pop out all the time. They said during the middle of the games, they would stop the game. But he went about 170 pounds at best.
Now, Greg, you mentioned we had this attempted bribery scandal, and your great-grandpa said no to this, by the way, but we had this attempted bribery scandal in Ohio. It set back pro football, but the teams are talking about this Ohio center of gravity in pro football. In a lot of ways, this set the stage for the formation of the NFL, 14 years later, right?
Absolutely. After the initial Pittsburgh era for 10 years, which is the birthplace. Canton still calls itself the cradle of pro football, which people don't quite get the nuance, but they recognize that they weren't the birthplace, but they have the Hall of Fame because the NFL was founded there in 1920, not because pro football started there. But nonetheless, it really matured there and was reborn there with Jim Thorpe and led to the founding of what was first called the American Pro Football Association in 1920 and 21, but they changed the name to the National Football League. But that's where the game really flourished.
And Greg, I got to ask, you mentioned seeing some of those photos up on the wall and then finding more of them. Do they have a prominent place in your home now?
Absolutely. Those three main larger frame ones still inhabit the wall of my billiard room, just like they did in my grandmother's billiard room. And it was pretty rare for a grandparent back in those days, especially in Pittsburgh, to have a billiard room. And most of the time they were cellars, very raw and you know, dirty. But she had a very elegant home in her community, which set them apart from many others there. And it made me feel like they were something special. And they were special because of my great-grandfather's legacy and the patriarch of the family that he was as a successful businessman and leader in their community as a justice of the peace after his pro football career. So his legacy of character and integrity, it's really special because imagine that he was an eighth grade graduate only from Pittsburgh who had to go to work at the Westinghouse Air Brake Corporation to help his family. And he rose to the peak of pro football surrounded by Ivy League educated players who were the best in the country from elite institutions, and they made him their captain. So that's very powerful to me and inspired me to understand more about him.
Greg, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks very much. It's at gridironlegacy.com. If you'd like a signed copy.
Greg Fisseri is the author of the new book, Gridiron Legacy, Pro Football's Missing Origin Story. Coming up after the news, former President Trump and a number of alleged accomplices face new charges in Georgia for their attempts to change the 2020 presidential election outcome. We'll dig into those new indictments. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the wildfire in Maui was the deadliest in the U.S. in over a century. We'll find out how climate change and development patterns can put more people at risk. Now, a grand jury in Georgia filed criminal charges against former President Donald Trump and others in Georgia earlier this week. Here's Fulton County District Attorney Fani Willis making that announcement.
A Fulton County grand jury returned a true bill of indictment, charging 19 individuals with violations of Georgia law arising from a criminal conspiracy to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election in this state.
This is the fourth criminal indictment brought against the former president this year. We're taking a look now at this latest round of indictments, how they fit into the broader legal landscape of charges brought against the former president, and updates from on the ground in Georgia. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions, what thoughts do you have about the most recent indictment of the former president? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll start in Georgia with Sam Greenglass, a reporter for WABE News in Atlanta, where he's been covering the Fulton County probe of the 2020 election. Sam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You've been watching this Fulton County probe evolve over the last, 2.5 years. Can you remind us how it got started there in Georgia?
So this investigation really began not long after this infamous phone call in the weeks after the 2020 election. This was between Georgia's Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, and then President Trump. Trump asked the Secretary of State to find him votes, the number of votes he would have needed to win Georgia, even though Joe Biden had already been declared the winner. A new district attorney in Fulton County had just taken office around that same time. And it wasn't long before she began this investigation in earnest to figure out if crimes had been committed in these efforts to subvert the election result in Georgia.
I know the prospect of indicting former President Trump, it's been contentious around the country. What has the chatter been in Georgia leading up to and now after these indictments were released?
Well, I think in the beginning, people were still really needing to digest. These indictments came late in the evening on Monday, so many people woke up to the news. I would say many Democrats see these charges as the first steps toward accountability for people who they see as having tried to chip away at their voting rights. And then within the Republican Party, it is more of a mixed bag. You have figures like Georgia's Secretary of State Raffensperger, who I just mentioned, who had a statement saying that the most basic principles of a strong democracy are accountability and respect for the Constitution. But then you have, the state party, Republican Party apparatus, who is calling this investigation partisan, channeling much the same language that we have heard from former President Trump and calling it a partisan witch hunt.
What happens next, Sam? You've got former President Trump, 18 other people charged here, and they what have to show up, I think, at a local jail to report in?
So the district attorney has told the defendants that they have until next Friday at noon to voluntarily surrender. They will be booked at the Fulton County Jail. And we've just learned this afternoon that the district attorney is requesting arraignments to begin the week of September 5th, heading toward a proposed trial date on March 5th of next year. So all of this is moving rather quickly after this long investigation, though I expect there to be many factors that slow this process down as we really get into it over the next couple of weeks and months.
And before I let you go, Sam, the district attorney, Fannie Willis, had hinted that, you know, there might be some sort of turmoil, protests, whatever might happen. Has there been any sign of that, at least so far, since this announcement late Monday?
You're right. The district attorney told law enforcement to prepare for a significant public response. She has talked about many of the threats that she's received, many of them racist. The law enforcement have said they've investigated many of them. But in the end, it was fairly quiet outside the courthouse this week, apart from the many TV trucks and throngs of reporters and police officers who were lined up. No real protests in downtown Atlanta as this decision has unfurled. But of course, there'll be plenty more opportunity. We have arraignments and booking and many more steps ahead in what's going to be a very long process.
Sam, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Sam Greenglass, reporter for WABE News in Atlanta, where he's been covering the Fulton County probe of the 2020 election. How do these charges fit into the growing list of indictments against former President Trump? Cheryl Bader is a clinical associate professor of law at Fordham University Law School and a former assistant U.S. attorney in the District of New Jersey. Cheryl, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's nice to be with you.
Now, this is the second set of indictments related to former President Trump's action in attempting to reverse the outcome of the 2020 election. How do you see what we saw in this indictment comparing to the federal indictment on these issues?
So there are a lot of similarities. They cover a lot of the same ground, but Smith took a very narrow focus. I think strategically he wanted to streamline the case. He only charged Donald Trump, even though there were other, you know, unnamed co-conspirators there. So that's a, you know, one big difference. Another difference is that, he went and a more cautious approach as to what he charged. For instance, he didn't even charge inciting an insurrection, which is something that many people were expecting. Whereas the indictment here, Willis has actually done a very expansive indictment, as was mentioned, 19 people, and also charged pretty aggressively, including the state's RICO statute, which gives her many advantages in terms of evidence that she can bring in.
I want to give a listen to District Attorney Fannie Willis in Georgia talking about that, the racketeer-influenced and corrupt organization, or RICO. Here's a listen.
Every individual charged in the indictment is charged with one count of violating Georgia's Racketeer-Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act through participation in a criminal enterprise in Fulton County, Georgia, and elsewhere to accomplish the illegal goal of allowing Donald J. Trump to seize the presidential term of office beginning on January 20th, 21.
Let's talk about that RICO concept, Cheryl. Different states have different statutes. Georgia's is a little more expansive, I understand it. But in general, what does it mean when prosecutors and grand juries are pursuing indictments under RICO laws?
So think of RICO as an umbrella crime, where there's one overarching scheme. Here it is to overturn the election. And what is called racketeering activity that's done in furtherance of that, you know, common corrupt goal. And so, you know, you bring in different levels of players into this one sort of nefarious enterprise that's charged. And originally, RICO was enacted to prosecute mob bosses who would be able to evade prosecution because although they ran the operation, they didn't get their hands dirty by committing the actual crimes. And so here we see, you know, many layers of, you know, the sort of, you know, top players, Trump and those in his inner circle, you know, working their way down to people who were just brought in for, you know, particular aspects of, you know, these conspiracies. And, you know, in general, you know, there's a lot of similarities between, you know, federal RICO or other state RICO statutes. You know, as I said, both bring in various criminal acts into sort of the one overarching scheme. But Georgia has a slightly broader approach in that it doesn't require quite as much continuity of the enterprise as some other states. It has a broader array of criminal activity that qualifies as racketeering conduct. For instance, here, lying to government officials, also soliciting a crime, right? That's sufficient. And courts in Georgia have interpreted it, you know, liberally in terms of what evidence gets to come in. And that's usually the big advantage of RICO, is it allows a prosecutor to bring in evidence that they may not otherwise be able to get in. And in Georgia, for instance, they can actually bring in evidence that happened in other states. And you see that in the indictment, references to activity that happened in other states or in other counties like, you know, Coffee County. And so, you know, that's a big advantage. And this prosecutor particularly likes and has used RICO effectively in the past.
And reading the indictment, again and again, there are, you know, outlines of activity. This is under the RICO charges now, where an individual act might be legal. A tweet from the then President Trump or a call to a government official. Those acts might not in and of themselves be illegal, but they're, it seems like, building a pattern of this wider goal, as you say, with the intent of overturning the election result. Can you talk about that kind of drumbeat of all these different activities that get painted through in the indictment?
Right. So some people might look at this and say, you know, why is it a crime to schedule a meeting, you know, in an official, you know, government building? That's not a crime, right? But that's one of the allegations that the, you know, for, in order to facilitate the false electors, you know, being able to meet and, you know, indicate falsely that they were the true electors. So we see that, you know, there's much activity about tweeting, et cetera, but it's to give context, you know, for the entire scheme. And so when, you know, when jurors are listening, they're not just looking at something in a silo, right? They understand how the pieces of the puzzle fit together and have a greater context, which is very important for a prosecutor telling a narrative.
We're talking to Cheryl Bader from Fordham University's School of Law, looking at the latest charges brought against former President Donald Trump and 18 alleged co-conspirators by a grand jury in Fulton County, Georgia, earlier this week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on this latest indictment? Do you have questions about it, about how this will work in practice? Do you think this might have an impact on Trump's campaign for president? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Cheryl Bader from the Fordham University School of Law, looking at the fourth and most recent criminal indictment against former President Donald Trump relating to attempts to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election outcome in the state of Georgia You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Join in with your reaction to this latest round of indictments against President Trump and 18 others. If you have questions for our guest about the various indictments against the former president, how they'll play out potentially in courts, you could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller. Aaron is with us in Oshkosh. Aaron, hi.
Yes, hello and good day, everybody. Thank you for taking the call. I was probably one of the last generations to actually go through a civics class in Madison, Wisconsin, back when they still did those things in high school. Now, it's been a while since I checked, and I believe that there are still requirements having to do with a person's character and not having criminal charges and these other restrictions that you had to do to, one, meet the bill to be able to run for either a public office, but especially the presidency. And with multiple felony charges against him in multiple districts across the country, both state, local, and federal, how is he even allowed to qualify to be able to run for the candidacy?
Aaron, thanks for the call. One important clarification, indictments and charges, but not convictions in any of these cases yet. And in constitutional law, Cheryl, you have to be a certain age. You have to meet citizenship requirements, and that's about it. So those kind of requirements aren't out there, as I understand it.
That's exactly right. One would think that we'd be learning in a civics class that you do have to have a certain character, but in fact, the Constitution doesn't speak to that. And so, you know, he could continue to hold office. There is sort of a little bit of an exception in the 14th Amendment that talks about when someone takes an oath to uphold the Constitution and they engage in insurrection, then they can't hold office. And so, you know, to the extent that in the, D.C. case, to the extent that there's evidence around, you know, inciting the insurrection could even if he's not, you know, convicted of those charges, could a hearing be brought, you know, through Congress? Possibly. Also in the documents case, there would be issues if he is convicted about him having a security clearance in the future. And if, you know, because of the Espionage Act charges. And so, you know, that would certainly, you know, pose a problem, you know, for him if he's elected again. But, you know, again, we'll have to see how those things play out. But it's, you know, it's up to the people, and they have to sort of vote. And it amazes me that we're at a point where, again, he hasn't been convicted of anything. But I can't imagine a time when a candidate could have been indicted, you know, multiple times for these type of charges, and it wouldn't have been the death knell for the campaign. But here we see a very strong Donald Trump.
Aaron, thanks a lot for that call. Cheryl, on a practical level, I understand the district attorney in Georgia wants to try all 19 defendants in one trial. I'm no lawyer. That sounds difficult, cumbersome, and time-consuming. What are you watching for on a practical level of bringing this through the courts?
Absolutely. It's very ambitious, and especially on the timetable that she seems to want to do this, right? You have, you know, 19 defendants, they're going to have lawyers. Some of them may have more than one lawyer. You have all these schedules to deal with. You also have, you know, multiple motions. They also have to all be prepared. And some of them may be representing, you know, Donald Trump in other cases. And so I think it may be quite unwieldy. We may have less defendants actually going to trial because people do plead guilty. You might see people also cooperating, some of the defendants cooperating in the case, but it's been done, but it's quite a lift. And I don't think the time frame that she's laying out is I think it's overly optimistic.
Go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Saul is with us in Stevens Point. Saul, hello.
Yeah, hi. Trump has a habit of throwing lawyers under the bus, and he's had trouble in the past of getting representation for that reason, either not paying them or betraying them. And I'm wondering whether that, and he's already making comments about how this this grand scheme is really the idea of a bunch of lawyers. He wasn't involved. I'm wondering whether, A, does that hold among, in this kind of a prosecution? Does that absolve him of guilt? And secondly, are they getting really hot testimony from some of the people that he's already indicated he's going to betray, I guess is the word.
Saul, thanks a lot for the call. A lot there. First of all, Cheryl, a possible defense Saul saying the president might make is, hey, my lawyers told me all this was fine, so I'm fine anyway. Maybe they're in trouble, but I'm not.
Right. So that may be his defense. I relied on the advice of my lawyer. But you know, that's fraught with certain problems. First of all, you can't cherry pick and, go through lawyer after lawyer. And remember, the Justice Department, the intelligence community, right? Everyone is telling him, that this is, a fantasy, that there has been no, fraud that would actually change the course of the election. And, for him to go through and find that one outlier that's going to tell him, okay, we might, find a way that this could work, I don't think is going to be a very viable defense. And also, as you said, they're also going to be all sitting in the courtroom. And so, sort of having the finger pointing both ways, well, he's the one that told me to do it. Well, he's the one that did it, right? Is I think something that the prosecutor will be happy to have that sort of crossfire back and forth.
Thanks a lot for that call. Saul at 800-642-1234. Cheryl, as this is going on, leading up to these indictments coming out, the former president had encouraged a public official in Georgia, to not testify to the grand jury. He's been critical of judges, district attorneys, and prosecutors in various cases. Could former President Trump be opening himself up to new charges, witness tampering, contempt of court, and others?
Yes, absolutely. We've seen, his very destructive rhetoric. And that's, I think, the reason why there has to be so much security, right? Trump has become the master of, parsing his words so that, his various supporters and minions sort of know what he's saying. And he there's been some really incendiary rhetoric around, defaming, prosecutors, judges, witnesses, law enforcement, and it's been very disturbing.
Now, looking at the various indictments working their way through the system now, Cheryl, I've seen some people make the case that, oh, these Georgia ones, these are the big deal. Others say, no, it's the Jack Smith January 6th ones. Which one do you watch more closely in the months to come? Which do you see as more significant, if either?
That's such a tough question because, it's sort of like comparing is arson worse than murder? It's, hard to compare the cases because there's so many, various factors. So as I said, in the documents case, I actually think that is the strongest case on the facts because they have, the smoking gun with, Trump showing these classified, very sensitive classified documents to people saying, oh, I know I could have declassified these previously, but I didn't, telling, someone that they couldn't get close to a map because it was classified and sensitive, instructing his lawyer to say that we don't have any more documents and to sort of lose the ones that you found, surveillance tapes, et cetera. So, but it's complicated by the fact that, other people, including, sort of Biden, Pence, have, also had, documents in their possession. Of course, it's a very different situation because they turned them over very readily. They opened, their space and said, here, take whatever you have. It was a mistake. Whereas Trump really tried to hide these documents. But, I think that could be a potentially strong case, although, that's also going to be to probably the most conservative jury pool of the four cases. And so, the case in D.C., which is a lot like the case in Georgia that we're seeing now, I think that has, the potential to go before the election.
And we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Cheryl Bader, Clinical Associate Professor of Law at Fordham University School of Law. We've been talking about the latest Trump indictment news, this one out of Georgia, and what we can expect to see as that case moves toward trial. It begins. My zucchini plants were a little slow to get rolling this year, but now they're starting to produce. I got a couple in the fridge right now, but wait. My sister-in-law had a very productive garden. I think she actually takes care of it or something. I don't know. And she was looking to unload some zucchinis. I accepted one big bag. She wanted us to take more. Yesterday's meal featured a side dish of zucchini, but I still have a lot left, including a couple of big ones. And we all know what that means. It means it's time to make some of the awesome zucchini relish recipe I found online a few years back. I'm sure I can make a few quarts with what I have. Still have plenty left for zucchini bread and probably some more side dishes. What is your favorite use for zucchini? Email ideas@wpr.org. I could probably use the help. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.